It could not have been very long before I regained consciousness, because I awoke to the sound of gunfire. I looked up. Japanese planes were flying down. There were flashes of red from the gun muzzles. They were shooting at the wreckage of old Abba, shooting to make sure there was no one in it. A little flicker of fire started at the engine, the only engine left, in the nose. It ran around toward the cabin where the fabric had been saturated with petrol. There was a sudden flare of white flame trapped by black smoke. Petrol was spilling on the ground, and it looked as if there was flame pouring down because the petrol was alight. Then there was just a boom, and wreckage came raining down, and Abba was no more. Satisfied at last, the Japanese planes made off. Now I had time to look about me, and to see where I was. To my horror, I found that I was in a deep drainage ditch, in a sewer. In China, many of the sewers are open, and I was in one of them. The stench was simply appalling. I consoled myself with the thought that at least the position in which I had found myself had saved me from Japanese bullets or from fire. Quickly I freed myself from the wreckage of the pilot's seat. I found that I had snapped both ankles, but with considerable effort I managed to crawl along on hands and knees, scrabbling at the crumbling earth to reach the top of the ditch, and to escape from the clinging mess of sewage. At the top of the bank, just across from the flames which still flickered on the petrol-saturated earth, I fainted again with pain and exhaustion, but heavy kicks in my ribs soon brought me back to consciousness. Japanese soldiers had been attracted to the spot by the flames, and they had found me. "Here is one who is alive," said a voice. I opened my eyes, and there was a Japanese soldier with a rifle with a fixed bayonet. The bayonet was drawn back, ready for a thrust at my heart. "I had to bring him back, so that he would know he was being killed," he said to a comrade of his, and he made to thrust at me. At that moment an officer came hurrying along. "Stop," he shouted. "Take him to the camp. We will make him tell us who were the occupants of this plane and why they were so guarded. Take him to the camp. We will question him." So the soldier slung his rifle on his shoulder, and caught hold of me by the collar and started to drag me along. "Heavy one, this. Give me a hand," he said. One of his companions came over and caught me by an arm. Together they dragged me along, scraping off the skin of my legs at the same time as I was pulled along the stony ground. At last the officer, who apparently was doing a routine inspection, returned. With a roar of rage he shouted, "Carry him." He looked at my bleeding body, and at the trail of blood I was leaving behind, and he smacked the two guards across the face with the flat of his hand. "If he loses any more blood, there will not be enough man to question, and I shall hold you responsible," he said. So for a time I was allowed to rest on the ground while one of the guards went off in search of some sort of conveyance. Because I was a large man, quite bulky, and the Japanese guards were small and insignificant. Eventually I was tossed like a sack of rubbish onto a one-wheeled barrow, and carried off to a building which the Japanese were using as a prison. Here I was just tipped off, and again dragged by the collar to a cell and left to myself. The door was slammed and locked, and the soldiers set to guard outside. After a few moments I managed to set my ankles, and put splints on. The splints were odd pieces of wood which happened to be in the cell, which apparently had been used as some sort of store. To bind these splints I had to tear strips from my clothing. For days I lay in the prison, in the solitary cell, with only rats and spiders for company. Fed once a day on a quart of water and on scraps left over from the tables of the Japanese guards, scraps which perhaps they had chewed, and found unsatisfying, and spat out. But it was the only food I had. It must have been more than a week that I was kept there, because my broken bones were getting well. Then, after midnight, the door was roughly flung open, and Japanese guards entered noisily. I was dragged to my feet. They had to support me because my ankles were still not strong enough to take my weight. Then an officer came in and smacked me across the face. "Your name?" he said. "I am an officer of the Chinese forces, and I am a prisoner of war. That is all I have to say," I replied. "Men do not allow themselves to be taken prisoners. Prisoners are scum without rights." "You will answer me," said the officer. But I made no reply. so they knocked me about the head with the flat of their swords. They punched me, kicked me, and spat at me. As I still did not answer, they burned me about the face and body with lighted cigarettes, and put lighted matches between my fingers. My training had not been in vain. I said nothing, they could not make me talk. I just kept silent and put my mind to other thoughts, knowing that that was the best way of doing things. Eventually a guard brought a rifle butt down across my back, knocking the wind out of me, and almost stunning me with the violence of the blow. The officer walked across to me, spat in my face, gave me a hard kick and said, "We shall be back, you will speak then." I had collapsed on the floor, so I stayed there, there was no other place to rest. I tried to recover my strength somewhat. That night there was no further disturbance, nor did I see anyone the next day, nor the day after that, nor the day after that. For 3 days and four nights I was kept with no food, no water, and without seeing anyone at all. Kept in suspense, wondering what would happen next. On the fourth day an officer came again, a different one, and said that they were going to look after me, that they were going to treat me well, but that I in return must tell them all that I knew about the Chinese, and about the Chinese forces and Chiang Kai-shek. They said that they had found out who I was, that I was a high noble from Tibet, and they wanted Tibet to be friendly with them. I thought to myself, well, they are certainly showing a peculiar form of friendship. The officer just made a bow, turned, and left. For a week I was reasonably well treated, given 2 meals a day, and water, and that was all. Not enough water, and not enough food, but at least they left me alone. But then 3 of them came together, and said that they were going to question me, and I was going to answer their questions. They brought a Japanese doctor in with them who examined me, and said that I was in bad shape, but I was well enough to be questioned. He looked at my ankles and said that it was a marvel that I could possibly walk after. Then they bowed ceremoniously to me, and ceremoniously to each other, and trooped out like a gang of schoolboys. Once again the cell door clanged behind them, and I knew that later on that day I was going to face interrogation once again. I composed my mind and determined that no matter what they did I would not betray the Chinese. Chapter 8. When the world was very young, in the early hours of next morning, long before the first streaks of dawn appeared in the sky, the cell door was flung open violently, to recoil against the stone wall with a clang. Guards rushed in, I was dragged to my feet, and shaken roughly by 3 or 4 men. Then handcuffs were put upon me, and I was marched off to a room which seemed to be a long, long way away. The guards kept prodding me with their rifle butts, not gently either. Each time they did this, which was all too frequent, they yelled, "Answer all questions promptly, you enemy of peace. We will get the truth from you." Eventually we reached the interrogation room. Here there were a group of officers sitting in a semicircle, looking fierce, or trying to look fierce. Actually, to me, they seemed to be a gang of schoolboys who were out for a sadistic treat. They all bowed ceremoniously as I was brought in. Then a senior officer, a colonel, exhorted me to tell the truth. He assured me that the Japanese people were friendly and peace-loving. But I, he said, was an enemy of the Japanese people because I was trying to resist their peaceful penetration into China. China, he told me, should have been a colony of the Japanese, because China was without culture. He continued, "We Japanese are true friends of peace. You must tell us all. Tell us of the Chinese movements, and of their strength, and of your talks with Chiang Kai-shek, so that we may crush the rebellion of China without loss of our own soldiers." I said, "I am a prisoner of war, and demand to be treated as such. I have nothing more to say." He said, "We have to see that all men live in peace under the emperor. We are going to have an expanded Japanese empire. You will tell the truth." They were not at all gentle in their methods of questioning. They wanted information, and they didn't mind what they did to get that information. I refused to say anything, so they knocked me down with rifle butts. Rifle butts dashed brutally against my chest or back, or at my knees. Then I was pulled to my feet again by guards so that I could be knocked down again. After many, many hours, during which time I was burned with cigarette ends, they decided that stronger measures were called for. I was bound hand and foot, and dragged off again to an underground cell. Here I was kept bound hand and foot for several days. The Japanese method of tying prisoners led to excruciating pain. My wrists were tied behind me with my hands pointing to the back of my neck. Then my ankles were tied to my wrists, and legs were folded at the knees, so that the soles of the feet also faced the back of the neck. Then a rope was passed from my left ankle and wrist around my neck, and down to the right ankle and wrist. So that if I tried to ease my position at all, I half strangled myself. It was indeed a painful process, being kept like a strong bough. Every so often a guard would come in and kick me just to see what happened. For several days I was kept like that, being unbound for half an hour a day only. For several days they kept me like that, and they kept coming and asking for information. I made no sound or response other than to say, "I am an officer of the Chinese forces, a non-combatant officer. I am a doctor and a prisoner of war. I have nothing more to say." Eventually they got tired of asking me questions, so they brought in a hose, and they poured strongly peppered water into my nostrils. I felt as if my whole brain was on fire. It felt as if devils were stoking the flames within me. But I did not speak, and they kept on mixing a stronger solution of pepper and water, adding mustard to it. The pain was quite considerable. Eventually bright blood came out of my mouth. The pepper had burned out the linings of my nostrils. I had managed to survive this for 10 days, and I supposed it occurred to them that that method would not make me talk, so, at sight of the bright red blood, they went away. 2 or 3 days later they came for me again, and carried me to the interrogation room. I had to be carried because this time I could not walk in spite of my efforts, in spite of being bludgeoned with gun butts and pricked with bayonets. My hands and legs had been bound for so long that I just could not use them at all. Inside the interrogation room I was just dropped to the floor, and the guards, 4 of them, who had been carrying me stood to attention before the officers who were sitting in a semicircle. This time they had before them many strange implements which I, from my studies, knew to be instruments of torture. "You will tell us the truth now, and cease to waste our time," said the colonel. "I have told you the truth. I am an officer of the Chinese forces." That was all I said in reply. The Japanese went red in the face with anger, and at a command I was strapped to a board with my arms outstretched as if I was on a cross. Long slivers of bamboo were inserted beneath my nails right down to the little finger joints, then the slivers were rotated. It really was painful, but it still brought no response. So the guards quickly pulled out the slivers, and then slowly, one by one my nails were split off backwards. The pain was truly devilish. It was worse when the Japanese dropped salt water onto the bleeding finger ends. I knew that I must not talk and betray my comrades, and so I called to mind the advice of my guide, the Lama Minyodon Dup. "Do not concentrate on the seat of pain, Lobsang, for if you do you focus all your energies on that spot, and then the pain cannot be borne. Instead think of something else. Control your mind, and think of something else, because if you do that you will still have the pain and the after effects of pain, but you will be able to bear it. It will seem as something in the background." So to keep my sanity, and to avoid giving names and information, I put my mind to other things. I thought of the past, of my home in Tibet, and of my guide. I thought of the beginnings of things as we knew them in Tibet. Beneath the Potala were hidden mysterious tunnels, tunnels which may hold the key to the history of the world. These interested me. They fascinated me, and it may be of interest to recall once again what I saw and learned there, for it is knowledge apparently not possessed by Western peoples. I remembered how at the time I was a very young monk in training. The inmost one, the Dalai Lama, had been making use of my services at the Potala as a clairvoyant, and he had been well pleased with me and as a reward had given me the run of the place. My guide, the Lama Minyodon Dup, sent for me one day, "Lobsang, I have been thinking a lot about your evolution, and I have come to the conclusion that you are now of such an age and have attained such a state of development that you can study with me the writings in the hidden caves. Come." He rose to his feet, and with me at his side we went out of his room, down the corridor, down many, many steps, past groups of monks working at their daily tasks, attending to the domestic economy of the Potala. Eventually, far down in the gloom of the mountain, we came to a little room branching off to the right of the corridor. Little light came through the windows here. Outside, the ceremonial prayer flags flapped in the breeze. "We will enter here," Lobsang, "so that we may explore those regions to which only few lamas have access." In the little room we took lamps from the shelves, and filled them. Then as a precaution, we each took a spare. Our main lamps were lit, and we walked out, and down the corridor, my guide ahead of me showing me the way. Down we went, down the corridor, ever down. At long last we came to a room at the end. It seemed to be the end of a journey to me. It appeared to be a storeroom. Strange figures were about, images, sacred objects, and foreign gods, gifts from all the world over. Here was where the Dalai Lama kept his overflow of gifts, those for which he had no immediate use. I looked about me with intense curiosity. There was no sense in being here, so far as I could see. I thought we were going exploring, and this was just a storage room. "Illustrious Master," I said, "surely we have mistaken our path in coming here?" The Lama looked at me and smiled benevolently. "Lobsang, Lobsang, do you think I would lose my wii?" He smiled as he turned away from me and walked to a far wall. For a moment he looked about him and then did something. As far as I could see, he was fiddling about with some pattern on the wall, some plaster protuberance apparently fabricated by some long-dead hand. Eventually there was a rumble as of falling stones, and I spun around in alarm, thinking that perhaps the ceiling was caving in or the floor was collapsing. My guide laughed. "Oh, no, Lobsang. We are quite safe, quite safe. This is where we continue our journey. This is where we step into another world. A world that few have seen. Follow me." I looked in awe. The section of the wall had slid aside, revealing a dark hole. I could see a dusty path going from the room into the hole, and disappearing into the Stygian gloom. The sight rooted me to the spot in astonishment. "But Master," I exclaimed, "there was no sign of a door at all there. How did it happen so?" My guide laughed at me, and said, "This is an entry which was made centuries ago. The secret of it has been well preserved. Unless one knows, one cannot open this door, and no matter how thoroughly one searches, there is no sign of a joint or of a crack. But come, Lobsang, we are not discussing building procedure. We are wasting time. You will see this place often." With that he turned and led the way into the hole, into the mysterious tunnel reaching far ahead. I followed with considerable trepidation. He allowed me to go past him, then he turned and again manipulated something. Again came the ominous rumbling and creaking and grating, and a whole panel of the living rock slid before my startled eyes and covered the hole. We were now in darkness, lit only by the flickering glimmer of the golden-flamed butter lamps which we carried. My guide passed me, and marched on. His footsteps, muffled though they were, echoed curiously from the rock sides, echoed, and re-echoed. He walked on without speaking. We seemed to cover more than a mile, then suddenly, without warning, so suddenly that I bumped into him with an exclamation of astonishment, the Lama ahead of me stopped. "Here we replenish our lamps, Lobsang, and put in bigger wicks. We shall need light now. Do as I do, and then we will continue our journey." Now we had a somewhat brighter flame to light our way, and we continued for a long, long way, for so long that I was getting tired and fidgety. Then I noticed that the passageway was getting wider and higher. It seemed as if we were walking along the narrow end of a funnel, approaching the wider end. We rounded a corridor and I shouted in amazement. I saw before me a vast cavern. From the roof and sides came innumerable pinpoints of golden light, light reflected from our butter lamps. The cavern appeared to be immense. Our feeble illumination only emphasized the immensity and the darkness of it. My guide went to a crevice at the left side of the path, and with a screech dragged out what appeared to be a large metal cylinder. It seemed to be half as high as a man and certainly as wide as a man at the thickest part. It was round, and there was a device at the top which I did not understand. It seemed to be a small, white net. The Lama Minya Dondup fiddled about with the thing, and then touched the top of it with his butter lamp. Immediately there was a bright yellow-white flame which enabled me to see clearly. There was a faint hissing from the light, as it was being forced out under pressure. My guide extinguished our little lamps then. "We shall have plenty of light with this, Lobsang, we will take it with us. I want you to learn some of the history from eons of long ago." He moved ahead pulling this great bright light, this flaming canister, on a thing like a little sledge. It moved easily. We walked on down the path once again, ever down, until I thought that we must be right down in the bowels of the earth. Eventually he stopped. Before me was a black wall, shot with a great panel of gold, and on the gold were engravings, hundreds, thousands of them. I looked at them, then I looked away to the other side. I could see the black shimmer of water, as if before me was a great lake. "Lobsang, pay attention to me. You will know about that later. I want to tell you a little of the origin of Tibet, an origin which in later years you will be able to verify for yourself when you go upon an expedition which I am even now planning," he said. "When you go away from our land you will find those who know us not, who will say that Tibetans are illiterate savages who worship devils and indulge in unmentionable rites. But Lobsang, we have a culture far older than any in the West. We have records carefully hidden and preserved going back through the ages." He went across to the inscriptions and pointed out various figures, various symbols. I saw drawings of people, of animals, animals such as we know not now, and then he pointed out a map of the sky, but a map which even I knew was not of the present day because the stars it showed were different and in the wrong places. The Lama paused, and turned to me. "I understand this, Lobsang. I was taught this language. Now I will read it to you, read you this age-old story, and then in the days to come I and others will teach you this secret language so that you can come here and make your own notes, keep your own records, and draw your own conclusions. It will mean study, study, study. You will have to come and explore these caverns, for there are many of them and they extend for miles beneath us." For a moment he stood looking at the inscriptions. Then he read to me part of the past. Much of what he said then, and very much more of what I studied later, simply cannot be given in a book such as this. The average reader would not believe, and if he did and he knew some of the secrets, then he might do as others have done in the past, use the devices which I have seen for self-gain, to obtain mastery over others, and to destroy others as nations are now threatening to destroy each other with the atom bomb. The atom bomb is not a new discovery. It was discovered thousands of years ago, and it brought disaster to the earth then as it will do now if man is not stopped in his folly. In every religion of the world, in every history of every tribe and nation, there is the story of the flood, of a catastrophe in which peoples were drowned, in which lands sank and land rose, and the earth was in turmoil. That is in the history of the Incas, the Egyptians, the Christians. Everyone. That, so we know, was caused by a bomb, but let me tell you how it happened, according to the inscriptions. My guide seated himself in the lotus position, facing the inscriptions on the rock, with the brilliant light at his back shining with a golden glare upon those age-old engravings. He motioned for me to be seated also. I took my place by his side, so that I could see the features to which he pointed. When I had settled myself he started to talk, and this is what he told me. "In the days of long, long ago Earth was a very different place. It revolved much nearer the sun, and in the opposite direction, and there was another planet nearby, a twin of the Earth. Days were shorter, and so man seemed to have a longer life. Man seemed to live for hundreds of years. The climate was hotter, and flora was both tropical and luxurious. Fauna grew to huge size and in many diverse forms. The force of gravity was much less than it is at present because of the different rate of rotation of the earth, and man was perhaps twice as large as he is now, but even he was a pygmy compared to another race who lived with him. for upon the earth lived those of a different system who were superintellectuals. They supervised the earth, and taught men much. Man then was as a colony, a class that is being taught by a kindly teacher. These huge giants taught him much. Often they would get strange craft of gleaming metal and would sweep across the sky. Man, poor ignorant man, still upon the threshold of dawning reason, could not understand it at all, for his intellect was hardly greater than that of the apes. For countless ages life on earth followed a placid path. There was peace and harmony between all creatures. Men could converse without speech, by telepathy. They used speech only for local conversations. Then the superintellectuals, who were so much larger than man, quarreled. Dissentient forces rose up among them. They could not agree on certain issues just as races now cannot agree. One group went off to another part of the world, and tried to rule. There was strife. Some of the supermen killed each other, and they waged fierce wars, and brought much destruction to each other. Man, eager to learn, learned the arts of war. Man learned to kill. So the earth, which before had been a peaceful place, became a troubled spot. For some time, for some years, the supermen worked in secret, one half of them against the other half. One day there was a tremendous explosion, and the whole earth seemed to shake and veer in its course. Lurid flames shot across the sky, and the earth was wreathed in smoke. Eventually the uproar died down, but after many months strange signs were seen in the sky, signs that filled the people of Earth with terror. A planet was approaching, and rapidly growing bigger and bigger. It was obvious that it was going to strike the Earth. Great tides arose, and the winds with it, and the days and nights were filled with a howling tempestuous fury. A planet appeared to fill the whole sky until at last it seemed that it must crash straight onto the Earth. As the planet got closer and closer, immense tidal waves arose and drowned whole tracts of land. Earthquakes shivered the surface of the globe, and continents were swallowed in the twinkling of an eye. The race of supermen forgot the quarrels, they hastened to their gleaming machines, and rose up into the sky, and sped away from the trouble besetting the earth. But on the earth itself earthquakes continued, mountains rose up, and the seabed rose with them, lands sank and were inundated with water. People of that time fled in terror, crazed with fear at what they thought was the end of the world, and all the time the winds grew fiercer, and the uproar and the clamor harder to bear, uproar and clamor which seemed to shatter the nerves and drive men to frenzy. The invading planet grew closer and larger, until at last it approached to within a certain distance and there was a tremendous crash, and a vivid electric spark shot from it. The skies flamed with continuous discharges, and soot-black clouds formed and turned the days into a continuous night of fearful terror. It seemed that the sun itself stood still with horror at the calamity, for, according to the records, for many, many days the red ball of the sun stood still, blood-red with great tongues of flame shooting from it. Then eventually the black clouds closed, and all was night. The winds grew cold, then hot, thousands died with the change of temperature, and the change again. Food of the gods, which some called manna, fell from the sky. Without it the people of the earth, and the animals of the world, would have starved through the destruction of the crops, through the deprivation of all other food. Men and women wandered from place to place looking for shelter, looking for anywhere where they could rest their weary bodies racked by the storm, tortured by turmoil, praying for quiet, hoping to be saved. But the earth shook and shivered, the rains poured down, and all the time from the outer space came the splashes and discharges of electricity. With the passage of time, as the heavy black clouds rolled away, the sun was seen to be becoming smaller and smaller. It seemed to be receding, and the people of the world cried out in fear. They thought the sun god, the giver of life, was running away from them. But stranger still, the sun now moved across the sky from east to west, instead of from west to east as before. Man had lost all track of time. With the obscuring of the sun there was no method with which they could tell its passage, not even the wisest men knew how long ago these events had taken place. Another strange thing was seen in the sky, a world, quite a large world, yellow, gibbous, which seemed as if it too was going to fall upon the earth. This, which we now know as a moon, appeared at this time as a relic from the collision of the two planets. Later races were to find a great depression in the earth, in Siberia, where perhaps the surface of the earth had been damaged by the close proximity of another world, or even a spot from whence the moon had been wrenched.